You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. I'm Kate Andrews, news editor at the IEA. Today I'm talking to the IEA's head of education, Dr. Steve Davies, about the state of the world economy. Despite showing good signs of health for the first time in a long time, people are still feeling nervous about the economy, both domestically and globally. Steve argues that there are two main reasons for this. First, the insecurity of China's central banking system, which has produced unsustainable bubbles that are bound to burst at some point. And second, the state of the world's money system, including the extended use of quantitative easing and low interest rates, which have also created a host of bubbles. Steve argues that this can't go on forever, and that if another recession hits, both central banks and governments are in a weak state to deal with lackluster economies. Steve is optimistic that after another recession, there may be an opportunity to sort out debts and create an era of more geopolitical stability. But in order to do that, we would have to get through another recession, which would take a combination of luck and good policymaking. If you like what you hear, subscribe to our iTunes channel, IEA Conversations. Steve, the world economy, at least in many areas, seems to finally be recovering, and yet many people are still so nervous. Why is this?
Well, to start off with, it's quite right, as you say, that the world economy is showing signs of reasonably good health for the first time in a long while. The recovery from the financial crisis of 2008 was unusually slow and weak compared to recoveries from previous recessions. And this was particularly true in the Eurozone, but also in Japan, in the United Kingdom, other parts of Europe, and in North America. And indeed, for quite a while, the major source of growth in the world economy was provided by China and other emerging markets. Now, in recent years, even the Eurozone in the last year or so has actually shown some positive growth. The American economy is now growing quite strongly, ditto the British economy. And so there is a widespread feeling that maybe we are finally out of the woods. Maybe we're finally on the path back to the kind of relatively stable and high growth world that we were in before the financial crisis. However, as you rightly say, a lot of people feel that actually this is not the case, and they're feeling quite nervous, in fact. And there's quite a lot of people who, although they find it quite hard to say why it is, feel anxious and a bit fearful about the next few years. And there's a number of reasons, actually, why this might be so. Top of the list, really, is China. As I said, China was the main motor of economic growth in the world economy for several years after 2008. By the standards it was enjoying before 2008, it wasn't growing that fast, but it was still doing really well by the standards of, say, the UK or even the United States. I think the Treasury in either country would have probably sold their souls to Satan to get the kind of growth rate China's had in the last 5 to 6 years. However, the problem is that this was built on the back of an enormous state infrastructure investment program and the issuance of a colossal amount of cheap money and debt by the Chinese central bank and the Chinese banking system and shadow banking system. And this has quite clearly led to a number of major bubbles, particularly in Chinese real estate. And the great fear, really, is that this is simply not sustainable and that sooner or later the bubble in China is going to burst, and that when it does, there's going to be the proverbial hard landing, with the Chinese economy suddenly showing severe signs of contraction. Now, quite apart from the effects this might have in China itself, where many people think it could lead to quite significant political unrest, there's also the problem that given China's much more important role in the world economy than was the case even just about a decade or so, or less than a decade ago, this would then have significant spillover effects on economic growth worldwide. Now, the situation right now is not that clear. It appears that the real estate bubble in China has burst, but it seems that at the moment there hasn't yet been major spillover effects. A lot of people fear, with some cause, I have to say, that actually this is only because the Chinese state has taken action to delay it by once again cranking up the money printing presses, and that sooner rather than later there is going to be a serious correction in China. And in fact, to be fair, there probably needs to be a serious correction, because they've built well over 40 airports, an enormous amount of infrastructure and real estate, and almost certainly this has been overbuilt. It's quite likely that they've built far more capital projects of one one kind or another, then the Chinese economy actually needs or can ultimately sustain in the medium term. And so a correction and a liquidation of bad debt is probably what China needs. But if that happens, it's not only going to be painful for them, it's going to be painful for the rest of us. And that brings me really, in a way, to the second major reason why a lot of people are feeling nervous, which is the state of the world's money system. Now, since 2008, we've had, of course, quantitative easing and a completely unprecedented, I think it's fair to say, monetary policy, where interest rates have been held at rates far lower than any ever recorded at any time in the last 300 years. There's also been a huge expansion of the base money supply through central bank purchases of sovereign debt in particular, but other assets as well to some degree. And one of the things this has done is to drive down the yield on government debt to, again, historically unprecedentedly low levels. The problem is that this has also created a whole series of asset bubbles, not just in China, but around the world. So real estate in places like Sydney, Vancouver, London, for example, is showing all the signs of being in a classic bubble. There are bubbles in both equities and bonds, and it's in fact also unprecedented to have both of those kinds of asset going up to that degree at the same time. They're normally inversely correlated. And then even things like old French wine, old paintings, collectibles, pretty much any kind of asset you can think of has risen sharply in value in the last 6 to 7 years. Now, the widespread feeling is that this can't go on forever. In addition, the world's central banks, particularly the Federal Reserve, but also maybe the Bank of Japan and the ECB, are thinking that they are going to start unwinding QE, that they're going to start raising interest rates back to a more normal level, and they're going to start sucking back in all that money they've created and releasing all the government debt that they bought in order to do that. Now, the fear is that if they do this, what will then become apparent is that there's an awful lot of really bad debt out there, that there are many, many people all around the world who have taken on debt that they simply can't afford to service, and at a reasonable rate of interest, that is. And what that means, of course, is that if we do in fact unwind QE, the fear is that there will then be a major correction with a lot of assets declining sharply in value and a knock-on effect in terms of blows to consumer and business confidence and a significant contraction in significant parts of the world economy. So not surprisingly, people are feeling very nervous about that. The obvious question then would be, well, if this is the case, why are the central banks not just letting QE roll on? But the reason, I think, is twofold. One is they are increasingly alarmed, I think it's fair to say, by the damage that such low interest rates are doing to saving and capital formation around the world. And secondly, they also think that, well, basically, you can't go on forever down this road. And it's a bit like driving down a highway in a car with no brakes on. And you know that if you sort of swerve off the road onto the hard shoulder or the grass verge to slow down, it's going to be very rough and uncomfortable. But if the alternative is to keep on driving when you've just passed a sign saying bridge out, then really, what else do you do?
All of this talk of bubbles and bad debt sounds a lot like the 2007-08 financial crash. Are we headed for a second recession?
Well, that's what many people fear. There are various candidates for triggering a financial crisis. Now, the problem is this may not happen, but the experience we had back in 2007-2008 has made people very anxious about the perceived instability and fragility of a large number of financial institutions, given things like the very great weakness of the Italian banking system, for example, and certain other European banking systems. And there's a number of candidates, as I said, for the thing that could tip the system over. One which is doing a lot of getting a lot of attention at the moment is the very high levels of car finance debt at the moment in particularly the United States, but also elsewhere, not least here in the United Kingdom. We've now moved to a situation where very few people actually buy a car. In the strict sense of that, what most people do is to take out a loan secured against the car. You make interest-only payments for a number of years, and then at the end of it, you either pay a large balloon payment and the car is yours, or more commonly, you hand the car back, you get a new car, and you roll the loan over. The problem is that if people start to find it unable to do this, and they hand the cars back in, then there's going to be a lot of trouble, not least because these loans are written on a truly perverse basis with the assumption that the value of the car remains constant, which of course is completely false. Everyone knows perfectly well that cars depreciate steadily and initially quite rapidly after you bought them.
Well, they say as soon as you drive it off the lot. Why, to go back to some of your previous statements, why did the first recovery take so long? I mean, some would argue that we still haven't recovered from the first financial crash. And given the implementation of things like quantitative easing and low interest rates, do the central banks, do governments have any more wiggle room if there were to be another crash?
They would have a lot less wiggle room than they did in 2008, 2009. I think the thinking of Ben Bernanke and the other central bankers was that they wanted to avoid the mistakes that the Fed made in the Great Depression in the 1930s, when between 1929 and 1932, the Fed shrank the US money supply by a truly staggering amount, over 25%. And it was that policy error that converted what would otherwise have been an unpleasant but not system-threatening recession into a global depression, because it brought down large chunks of the world financial system. So Ben Bernanke, in particular, was determined to avoid making that mistake. And I think it's probably fair to say that the QE and the monetary policies we've followed have prevented that kind of thing from happening. But as is usually the case, in trying to avoid one set of mistakes, I think the policymakers have avoided them but made new ones. And I think the reason why the recovery was so slow, in my view, is simply because the underlying problem that brought about the financial crisis was not dealt with, and that was the already very large amount of private debt, much of which was probably realistically never going to be repaid, certainly not in full. And what should have been done was to have a recognition of this and have a large amount of that debt written off, or more likely renegotiated, with the holders taking a probably quite significant haircut. Now, this would have meant that a lot of rich people suddenly discovered they weren't anywhere near as rich as they thought they were, the creditors basically. But also the fear at the time, I'm sure this is what concerned Bernanke and the others, was that it might lead to a huge blow to business confidence and trigger what they wanted to avoid, which was a sharp downturn. But I think they're probably now regretting that they didn't bite the bullet of private debt at the time and liquidate a fairly large amount of it, because now, as you rightly say, they don't have that many tools left in their toolbox if there is to be another recession. And so if that's the case, what are they going to do? They're going to be probably going to have to do what they should have done 8 years ago and go down the rather painful route of liquidating a large amount of bad debt. And it's worth saying, this is the other reason why people are nervous about the present situation, that we're overdue a recession anyway. You typically have a major recession every 7 years or so in the world economy, and then typically they last about 6 to 9 months, and then things go on. So we're really overdue another one already. And the problem is, the fear is, that we are still in such a fragile state that we can't take another recession. Because even if one arises naturally, it might trigger the kind of defaults on things like car loans that will then once again spark a financial crisis.
Will there be a political appetite to do what needs to be done? Moving away from the central banks for a moment and looking at government policy, the Conservatives in the UK have now implemented 7 years of austerity. This is not tolerable to the general public anymore. A lot of people would argue that's because they never implemented austerity in the first place. They did very, very, very small cuts in certain sectors to try to get the deficit down, but never tackled it altogether. What would happen now if that recession did come along and another government said, you know, we need to tighten the reins again?
I think that would be politically unsupportable, I'm afraid. The problem is now that the politicians have got themselves into a very, very difficult situation. They correctly tried to bring public spending under control and to bring it back into some kind of balance, but they did so in completely the wrong way. What happened actually was that while the overall reduction in public spending in Britain and elsewhere was quite low, in Britain in particular, the cuts were concentrated on a very small part of public spending, less than 25% of it. So some departments, like local government and communities, or the police and civil justice department, they got cuts of up to 25%, which is a big number in anybody's book, whereas the great bulk of government spending was not touched at all. And meanwhile, because we'd simply had the kind of, as it turned out, placeholder of QE, and the underlying problems of debt had not been dealt with, the recovery was very, very slow. So not surprisingly, the public is now at the end of its patience, because it's put up with what they perceive as very severe austerity for a number of years without seeing a really significant payoff in terms of rising incomes or economic improvement. So I think the initial reaction to another crisis would be demands for populist economic policies of both left and right. Now, I think it would become very obvious very, very quickly that these were simply not sustainable and were not going to work. But there's almost certain, I fear, going to be an effort to do that in the short run. And also, of course, if the governments and the central banks do now bite the bullet and allow a large amount of bad debt to be liquidated, this will be in the context of quite a severe short-term economic contraction. So the short-term outlook is potentially quite bad, unless, as I've no doubt they're all hoping, we can muddle through for a few more years and hope that certain something turns up, as Mr. McCorber used to put it.
To go back to your top point about China's economy causing lots of anxiety, the Financial Times has been doing some excellent reporting the past few weeks, noting not just the economic ambitions of China, but also the power plays of China that are coming to the fold right now. Yet the Western world seems so distracted by Donald Trump and Brexit, this is going under their radar.
This is absolutely true. And the final category of risks that concern people at the moment is geopolitical risks, which almost by their nature are highly unpredictable and unforeseeable, both in terms of when they might happen and what their effects are. So if we'd been having a conversation like this in the summer of 1914, we might have been pretty anxious about the situation in Ulster and the state of the British labour relations, but it would have looked as though the world economy was doing pretty well at that time, and indeed it was. But then, of course, as we all know, something suddenly happened in July and August of 1914 that put paid to all that for quite a long time. And so the great fear, of course, is that something might kick off in the Middle East, maybe a war in the Korean Peninsula, although actually I think that's less likely than many people realise. And this could obviously have completely unforeseeable effects. I think that what the Chinese are doing is partly pursuing what, from their point of view, is the completely rational strategy that almost any Chinese government would do. So, for example, they're building railways and roads all over Africa, Central Asia, other parts of the Asian landmass in the Middle East, for example. This so-called Belt and Road initiative that Xi Jinping is pushing. And I think this has two reasons. One is a straightforward economic motive, which is to improve trade links between China and the rest of the world, and in particular make it easier for the Chinese to ship manufactured goods out and for them to import raw materials in. But I think there's another geostrategic reason for it, which is to create a set of trade routes which can't be cut by the US Navy. And that's, in terms of the geopolitics, a rational thing to do. And as you say, I think the Chinese are taking advantage, in the geopolitical sense, of the perceived vacuum of leadership from the United States, which I wouldn't blame totally on Donald Trump. I think this is something that goes back before him, and it reflects rather the difficulties and problems that the United States has got itself into in the last couple of decades, really. So this is to be expected, I'm afraid. Now, is this likely to have disastrous results? In my view, if and only if people are not clear about where their red lines are. To go back to Korea, for example, the crucial issue there is for the United States to make very clear to the North Koreans what their red lines are, the things that would definitely provoke an armed response if the Koreans were to do them. The Chinese have been very clear about what their red lines are, and so their position is very, very clear. I think that one of the problems we do have at the moment is that the position of the United States is not clear, and there's a temptation perhaps for the North Koreans to think that, oh, a lot of what the administration is saying is just bluster, and they'll maybe then do something that, had they had a clearer message, they would not have done, because they would know otherwise that that's just not the thing to do. I am reasonably hopeful, though, that this will actually be worked out, simply because the costs of a misstep would be so catastrophic. Generally speaking, that's true more widely, I should say. It's that the major players, the United States, the rising powers such as China, and to some extent India, they need to just be very, very clear and very explicit about what their vital interests are, what their red lines are, and what is not behind a red line, and it's when things are on that basis and everyone knows where they stand that the dangers of an accidental misjudgment or major war are hugely reduced, because typically people start wars when they misread the signals that other players are giving out and think they're going to get away with something when they don't.
A lot of people out there who are rather apathetic towards politics, quite fairly so, won't be as clued up on the geopolitical situation with China or what the policy is of the central banks. But they're feeling anxious too. What is it that's making people feel anxious on that day-to-day basis who aren't necessarily clued up to the political sphere?
I think it's basically the relative stagnation of incomes since 2008. People have got used, many people, at least people in employment anyway, to a fairly stable rise in the standard of living. Either your income goes up, or even if your income doesn't go up very much, you find that there's lots of new products you can buy, the cost of products is steadily going down, so your standard of living goes up. Since the financial crisis, there's been very little increase in real incomes for a large number of people, and not surprisingly, people start to feel a bit anxious about this, particularly if they've taken on financial commitments in order to get things that they feel they would like to have and otherwise couldn't afford to have, or because they feel that maybe things are going to get better and they take on financial commitments anticipating that, and then start to feel rather anxious if they find their income isn't going up perhaps in the way that they anticipated. So I think that's the overwhelmingly the main reason. And I think the other reason is simply that a lot of people do actually have a lot of debts. Now, right now, those debts are very easy to service and relatively painless because of the extremely low levels of interest rate. But people are not stupid, and they are well aware that if interest rates do start to rise, that mortgage might suddenly start to be taking a really significant chunk out of your disposable income, and even more so perhaps your car loan or the hire purchase agreement or credit card credit that you've taken out. And so I think that combination of stagnant real incomes and steadily accumulating household debt is what is making quite a lot of people feel nervous and anxious, even though, as you say, they've never read the financial reports and they aren't anxious for the reason that some financial professionals are.
Is there any room to be optimistic here?
Yes, I think that in the medium term, we should be very optimistic. I think it's just the next 5 to 6 years that are quite likely going to be a bit unpleasant, in my view. That's because we almost certainly are going to have a recession. I think statistically it's really quite unlikely that we can avoid that, and that may well trigger some quite bad consequences. How bad depends on a combination of luck and the good judgment of policymakers, basically. However, I think that once we're past that, and in particular if we have finally done what we should have done several years ago and sorted out the problem we have of accumulated debt, then I think the prospects is very good, given the technological developments that we're seeing, the continued growth of other parts of the world economy, and the potential move towards an, I think, more stable geopolitical order. Because I do actually think, contrary to what many people believe, that a multipolar world is actually more stable than a unipolar or bipolar one. The internal dynamics of a multipolar world are normally and should be ones which involve cooperation between the major players to maintain the status quo, as happened, for example, in Europe after the Congress of Vienna. And that's a much more stable geopolitical situation, I think, than the one we've had recently.
Thanks, Steve. For more blogs, podcasts, films, and reports, visit our website, iea.org.uk.